Hello, I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi, and it's time for our birthdays. Ruth Christensen of Adel, happy birthday to you. Rosa Mae Osterberg of Spencer, it's your birthday. We hope you have a great one today. Mae Lusaf of Clive, happy birthday to you and many happy returns. If today is also your birthday and you didn't hear your name along with Ruth's, Rosa Mae's, and Mae Lou's, please give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Here's a reminder that our program schedule has changed dramatically so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. Let's get back to the news by turning to today's USA Today. We'll begin with five things the editors say we need to know this weekend. First, coronavirus infections down, air travel up. Memorial Day weekend is a big test. It's officially Memorial Day weekend. Coronavirus infections are dropping, and 50% of the American adults are fully vaccinated. It's a recipe for a big serving of travel. More than 37 million people are expected to go 50 miles or more from home this weekend, a 60% jump compared to last year, but still 6 million people fewer than the pre-pandemic Memorial Day weekend in 2019, according to AAA. Memorial Day weekend will be a test of whether the U.S. can avoid the spikes in infections and hospitalizations that occurred amid and after the winter holidays before vaccines were widely available. The takeaway from the CDC Director Rochelle Walensky, quote, if you are vaccinated, you're protected and you can enjoy your Memorial Day, end quote. Second, Biden to appear at Delaware Memorial Day event. President Joe Biden, who is in his home state of Delaware for the weekend, will attend the Delaware Commission of Veterans Affairs annual Memorial Day ceremony Sunday morning at War Memorial Plaza near Newcastle, the White House said Friday. Last year, the then presumptive Democratic nominee for the 2020 presidential election, Biden marked Memorial Day by making an unscheduled appearance at the same park, laying a wreath while wearing a mask as the country was in the early stages of the coronavirus pandemic. Biden's appearance will come after a busy Friday that saw him appear at a rock climbing facility in Virginia alongside Governor Ralph Northam to tout the state's progress in combating the pandemic, pay tribute to the armed forces at an Air Force base elsewhere in Virginia, and unveil a massive $6 trillion budget proposal that would increase the national debt to a percentage of the economy higher than it was in World War II. Third, additional details emerge in San Jose mass shooting. The investigation into the latest mass shooting in the U.S. will continue this weekend in San Jose, California, as information about the suspected shooter and the massacre continue to come to light. Local authorities weren't notified in 2016 after federal officers detained the man accused of killing 9 of his co-workers this week and found him with books about terrorism and writings detailing his hatred of the rail yard where he worked, the Santa Clara County District Attorney told USA Today Friday. Authorities reported finding 12 firearms and 22,000 rounds of ammunition at the home of the suspected gunman. Employees described the suspect, who died by suicide after the shooting, as being disgruntled, and officials said he clearly planned the attack. Fourth, drivers, start your engines. The Indianapolis 500 returns Sunday. The Indianapolis 500 will welcome a sold-out 135,000 spectators Sunday, the largest crowd at a sporting event since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, and drop the green flag on a packed house and a party not seen in over a year. Indianapolis Motor Speedway can normally accommodate nearly 400,000 on race day, but Roger Penske, who bought the Speedway in January 2020, only got clearance to permit 40% attendance. Nonetheless, Penske said he thinks, quote, with Opening America, we can be the premier event, and that, quote, it's an honor for us to even be in a position to execute something like that, end quote. Reigning IndyCar Series champion Scott Dixon won the coveted pole for the race and will lead the 33-car field. He won by just 0.03 miles per hour at the end of qualifying for his fourth Indy 500 pole, after winning it and also in 2017, 2015, and 2008, when he won the iconic race. And fifth, after a delay, the French Open to begin Sunday in Paris. The French Open, tennis's second major tournament of the year, will begin Sunday at Roland Garros in Paris. Returning to the month of May after being played in September last year due to the pandemic, the event is back in its rightful spot on the calendar, except for being delayed by a week because of COVID-19 concerns. Naomi Osaka of Japan, the world's number two ranked women's player, made headlines this week when she announced she would not speak to press at the tournament, taking the unusual step as a way to preserve her mental health. She also said she is willing to pay a fine for not fulfilling media responsibilities. On the men's side, 13-time French Open champion Rafael Nadal and both of his longtime rivals, Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer, are in the same half of the bracket for the first time at a Grand Slam tournament. In the latest coronavirus updates compiled by Eleanor Aspergren and Ryan W. Miller of USA Today, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas told ABC on Friday the U.S. is taking, quote, a very close look, end quote, at the possibility of the use of vaccine passports for international travel. However, officials would have to ensure any passport system, quote, is accessible to all and that no one is disenfranchised, Mayorkas said. CVS is offering a chance to win a trip to the Super Bowl, a Bermuda vacation, or cash prizes to bring in more customers for COVID-19 vaccinations. Kroger is also offering customers, workers, or individuals who get the shot the chance to win $1 million or free groceries for a year. Mexico gave emergency use authorization to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, according to the country's drug regulators. And just over 50 days away from the start of the Olympics, Japan on Friday extended its COVID-19 state of emergency in Tokyo and other areas for 20 more days. The games have already been delayed a year, but worries about variants and Japan's slow vaccine rollout have raised fears of a possible cancellation. A Tennessee woman is facing felony reckless endangerment charges after she sped through a vaccine clinic shouting, quote, no vaccine, end quote, the Blount County Sheriff's Office said. In the latest numbers, the U.S. has more than 33.2 million confirmed coronavirus cases and 593,700 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University data. The global totals, over 169.1 million cases and 3.51 million deaths. More than 132.7 million Americans have been fully vaccinated, 40% of the population. In news from Washington, Bart Janssen and Savannah Behrman of USA Today write, quote, the truth is hard, end quote. Senate Republicans block commission to study Capitol riot of January 6th. Senate Republicans on Friday blocked a bipartisan commission proposed to study the U.S. Capitol riot on January 6th. The Senate voted 54-35 Friday on whether to debate the measure, which fell short of the 60 votes needed to overcome a GOP filibuster, which blocks debate of the measure. The House had approved legislation to create the commission with support from 35 Republicans. Quote, I can't imagine anyone voting against the establishment of a commission on the greatest assault since the Civil War on the Capitol, President Joe Biden said Thursday in Cleveland. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, called the vote to focus the spotlight on Republicans who were reluctant to study what provoked the attack that left 5 dead and 140 police officers injured. Quote, we have to investigate, expose, and report on the truth. We need to establish a trusted record of what really transpired on January 6th and the events that preceded it, Schumer said. quote, the truth of the matter seems to be that Senate Republicans oppose the commission because they fear that it might upset Donald Trump and their party's midterm messaging, end quote. Quote, Senate Republicans must decide if they are on the side of truth or on the side of Donald Trump's big lie, Schumer added. White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said after the vote Friday that, quote, members of the Senate aren't sent to Washington to rubber stamp any party's views. They swear an oath to support and defend the Constitution. And today, unfortunately, they failed to do that, end quote. To hasten a vote on the commission, the Senate postponed votes to complete research and development legislation to counter China until June. Among its many facets, the measure would boost the semiconductor industry and spur efforts to compete better against China in science and technology. But the measure that enjoys broad bipartisan support became contentious because a handful of Republican senators sought amendments for issues such as better securing the southern border. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, opposed the commission. He said the Justice Department is already prosecuting 445 suspects in the attack, with more arrests expected. Legislative committees are already holding hearings and drafting recommendations to prevent another attack, he said. McConnell accused Democrats of wanting to relitigate Trump, who was impeached in the House and charged with inciting the insurrection. The Senate acquitted Trump. Quote, obviously, the role of the former president has been litigated exhaustively in the high-profile impeachment trial we had here in the Senate several months ago, McConnell said. Quote, I do not believe the additional extraneous commission that Democratic leaders want would uncover crucial new facts or promote healing, end quote. Republican Senators Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Rob Portman of Ohio, Mitt Romney of Utah, and Ben Sasse of Nebraska joined Democrats in supporting the commission. Senator Mike Rounds, a Republican from South Dakota, said the Justice Department could never share its information about the cases until they are prosecuted, but that he would support a commission once those investigations are complete. Quote, as a practical matter, I don't think that we can do this thing until after a lot of those criminal probes are completed, Rounds said. I still would like to see a commission go through just for history's sake. I'd like to see it, but I think we're going to have to wait until after the criminal prosecutions are completed, end quote. Gladys Sicknick, the mother of Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, who died of natural causes the day after he was sprayed with chemical spray in the attack, met Thursday with senators to urge a commission that would explain what happened. She was joined by D.C. Police Officer Michael Fanone, who suffered a heart attack after being beaten by rioters, and Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn, who is black and heard racial slurs during the attack. Quote, they put their lives on the line, said Sicknick, who called opposition to the commission, quote, a slap in the face, end quote. Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, met with Sicknick for what he called a respectful conversation. But he opposed the commission because he expects partisan results. Quote, I'm not sure what other questions remain unanswered after all those investigations, Johnson said. Quote, this would be a political commission. That's the bottom line here, and that's why I won't support it, end quote. Senator Mitt Romney said his meeting with Sicknick was a chance to express his condolences and, quote, hear about the experiences of two officers who were involved as well, end quote. Murkowski, who also supports the commission, said she shared, quote, serious hugs, end quote, with Sicknick's relatives and the officers. Quote, I am heartsick that you feel that you need to come and advocate to members of Congress that we stand up and say, quote, the truth is hard, but the truth is necessary, end quote. Murkowski said she told them. Four former secretaries of the Department of Homeland Security, Republicans Tom Ridge and Michael Chertoff, and Democrats Janet Napolitano and Jay Johnson, urged Congress to create a commission in a joint statement Thursday. Quote, we must understand how the violent insurrection at the Capitol came together to ensure the peaceful transfer of power in our country is never so threatened again, the statement said. But even among the seven Republicans who voted to convict Trump at his impeachment trial earlier this year, opinion was divided. Murkowski said an independent review is more important than short-term political concerns. Quote, I don't want to know, but I need to know, and I think it's important for the country that there be an independent evaluation, Murkowski said. to be making a decision for the short-term political gain at the expense of understanding and acknowledging what was in front of us on January 6th, I think we need to look at that critically." End quote. Despite his own support, Romney said others think the investigations by the Homeland Security and Rules Committees will be enough. Quote, "I think the attack on the building was a very severe attack on democracy and is having shockwaves around the world," Romney said. Senator Richard Burr, a Republican from North Carolina, opposed it because legislative committees are already reviewing the attack and drafting recommendations to prevent another one. Collins proposed changes in how the commission staff is chosen and a firmer deadline for a commission report in an effort at compromise. But other Republicans said the changes weren't enough to win support. Cassidy said that if the concern was that the commission would be partisan, Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, could simply appoint special committees to study the attack. In other news from Washington, Maureen Grappi of USA Today writes, "Highest debt since World War II, looming fight on taxes. Takeaways from Joe Biden's budget." The $6 trillion budget proposed by President Joe Biden on Friday gives a fuller fiscal picture than an April preview in which he laid out his spending priorities. The plan details taxes and spending for the fiscal year that begins in October. But a 10-year outlook also incorporates the multi-year spending on infrastructure, education, childcare, and other domestic programs proposed through what Biden has called his American Jobs and American Families plans. It's up to Congress, which is narrowly controlled by Democrats, to decide what gets implemented. Here's a look at some of the highlights. Record debt. The budget projects the federal debt would increase relative to the size of the economy to a higher level than during World War II. That will give Republicans more fodder for their attacks on Biden's so-called tax and spend agenda. During the World War II era, debt peaked at 106% of gross domestic product in 1946. Under Biden's plan, debt is projected to rise to 117% of the size of the economy by 2031. Without changes, it's expected to grow to 113% of the GDP. The administration argues that the level of interest payments, rather than the size of the debt, is the most relevant benchmark for whether debt is burdening the economy. The government's annual interest payments after adjusting for inflation would remain well below the historic average throughout the next decade, according to the White House. Deficits improve. The government would spend $1.8 trillion more than it's projected to take in next year. But by 2031, the deficit would decline relative to the size of the economy to a smaller share than it would be without Biden's changes. That's in part because Biden has proposed paying for some of his ambitious agenda through higher taxes on corporations and the wealthiest households. But the president's plan does not address the structural deficit that existed before the pandemic. That imbalance is driven by an aging population, rising health care costs, compounding interest, and the lack of sufficient tax revenues to keep up. Trump tax cuts. Biden's budget assumes that reductions in taxes approved in 2017 under President Donald Trump will still expire in 2025, as is current law. If that happens, however, that would violate Biden's campaign to not raise taxes on Americans making $400,000 or less. White House Acting Budget Director Shalanda Young said there's time before 2025 for Biden to work with Congress, quote, "to continue reforming our tax code so that it asks the wealthy to pay their fair share, raises the right amount of revenue, and protects the low and middle income families," end quote. Public insurance option. Although Biden campaigned on lowering the enrollment age for Medicare and creating a public insurance option, his plan does not include a way to do that. Instead, the proposal only calls on Congress to take action this year to lower prescription drug costs and expand and improve health coverage. The plan notes that the money saved from reducing the amount of money Medicare pays for prescription drugs could be used to pay for coverage expansion. But congressional Democrats are divided over how to address drug prices as well as how to spend the savings. Quote, "We know there are proposals on the Hill being introduced, and we believe that it's more productive to work collaboratively with Congress to develop and build consensus around specific policies that achieve his broad goals," Young told reporters. Abortion funding. Biden angered anti-abortion activists and pleased abortion rights groups by something he did not include in his first budget request, a ban on federal funding of most abortions. The real fight over the issue will be in Congress, where Democrats may not be able to keep the ban, known as the Hyde Amendment, from being added to spending bills as it has been for decades. But Biden's decision was noteworthy, as he was a longtime supporter of the ban until he reversed position during the 2020 campaign. In addition, the move comes soon after the Supreme Court agreed to hear a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade and as abortion restrictions have increased in conservative states. The ban dramatically limits coverage of abortion under Medicaid, the health care program for the poor, and under federal programs. When Biden became the last 2020 Democratic presidential contender to come out against the ban, he described his change in position as a matter of equity. Quote, "If I believe health care is a right, as I do, I can no longer support an amendment that makes that right dependent," end quote, on others who are trying to limit abortion access in some states, Biden said at a Democratic National Committee event in 2019. Anti-abortion activists argue Americans who oppose abortion shouldn't be forced to share in the cost of abortion services through their tax dollars. Spending priorities. Biden's proposal is a reversal of priorities from Trump's budget plans, which slashed domestic programs and asked Congress for much higher military spending. Biden is asking for a nominal increase for the Pentagon, but big boosts in spending on education, housing, public health, the environment, and more. The administration argues that past so-called disinvestment in those areas have hurt the nation's ability to combat climate change, rebuild the economy, and address racial inequities. Quote, "I believe this is our moment to rebuild an economy from the bottom up and the middle out," Biden said during a trip to Cleveland Thursday. Quote, "Not a trickle-down economy from the very wealthy," end quote. In U.S. health news, Taylor Avery of USA Today has written an article titled, "A Color-Coded System Could Help People Make Healthier Choices at Food Pantries, Study Shows." Food pantry patrons make healthier choices when foods are organized by nutrition level, new research shows. Using a food categorizing system called Supporting Wellness at Pantries, or SWAP, that ranks different foods based on its level of saturated fat, sodium, and added sugars, researchers found that patrons selected 11% more health foods and decreased unhealthy choices by 7%. Quote, "The most important finding from this study is that people who go to food pantries, like all of us, want to eat a healthy diet, and it's very hard to quickly figure out which items are the healthiest," said Marlene Schwartz, director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity and an author of the study. Quote, "The purpose of SWAP is to just simplify that whole process by doing all of the evaluating ahead of time, having a simple color-coded system that's very easy to understand," end quote. Under the system, healthiest foods labeled green are placed at eye level with the sign "Choose Often." Less healthy foods are labeled yellow, and the least healthy foods tagged red go on the bottom shelf with a sign labeled "Choose Rarely." Katie Martin, executive director of the Institute for Hunger Research and Solutions and the designer of the SWAP system, said the study, which evaluated choices at a food bank in the northeastern United States for a week, validates previous findings. Quote, "There's demand for healthy foods that vulnerable populations who are struggling not only with food insecurity, but often with chronic diseases, are interested in selecting at food pantry settings," said Martin, a study co-author. SWAP already is being used at 25 food banks and 50 food pantries nationwide, and more are interested, Martin said. Jessica Hager, director of Healthcare Partnerships and Nutrition at Feeding America, hopes the program catches on. Quote, "SWAP is one of the many tools that I believe food banks should consider as part of their work when it comes to engaging with communities and supporting communities' food needs," she said. "The need is great. Food insecurity increased during the COVID-19 pandemic, reaching an estimated 45 million people during 2020, according to Feeding America. Last year, the organization saw a 44% increase in meals distributed compared to 2019, and as many as 4 in 10 people became first-time food bank users. "There's an attitude toward the charitable food system that people should take what's available," said Schwartz, "but that's the wrong way to think about it." Quote, "People who are using this system, we know from research, are at higher risk of diet related to chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes, hypertension, heart disease," she said. quote, so we almost need to go in the other direction and say, what are the absolute healthiest foods that we can provide? Because chances are that isn't the type of foods that this particular family has access to otherwise afford, end quote. In world news, Germany finally recognizes Namibia mass killings as genocide, agrees to pay $1.3 billion. This is an article by Gerhard Molson of the Associated Press, published in USA Today. Germany has reached an agreement with Namibia that will see it officially recognize as genocide the colonial-era killings of tens of thousands of people and commit to spending a total of 1.1 billion euros, or $1.3 billion, largely on development projects. The accord announced Friday is the result of more than 5 years of talks with Namibia on the events of 1904 through 1908, when Germany was the Southern African country's colonial ruler. Historians say German General Lothar von Trotha, who was sent to what was then German Southwest Africa to put down an uprising by the Herero people in 1904, instructed his troops to wipe out the entire tribe. They say about 65,000 Herero were killed and at least 10,000 Nama. Quote, in the light of Germany's historical and moral responsibility, we will ask Namibia and the descendants of the victims for forgiveness, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas said in a statement. Quote, our aim was and is to find a joint path to genuine reconciliation in remembrance of the victims, he said. That includes our naming the events of the German colonial era in today's Namibia, and particularly the atrocities between 1904 and 1908, unsparingly and without euphemisms, end quote. Quote, we will now officially call these events what they were from today's perspective, a genocide, end quote. Talks between Germany and Namibia opened in 2015, more than a decade after a 2004 visit to Namibia, in which then-development minister Heidemarie Wickersarek-Zoll offered Germany's first apology for the killings, which she said were, quote, what today would be labeled as genocide, end quote. Maas said that, quote, as a gesture of recognition of the incalculable suffering, end quote, Germany plans to support Namibia and the descendants of the victims with a 1.1 billion euro, quote, rebuilding and development, end quote, program, in whose design and implementation, quote, the communities affected by the genocide will take a decisive role, end quote. At the same time, he said that, quote, legal claims to compensation cannot be derived from this, end quote. That reflects Germany's position that the Genocide Convention of 1948 can't be applied retroactively and that its liability is political and moral rather than legal. The projects Germany will now fund are expected to stretch over a 30-year period and will cover areas such as land reform, including land purchases, agriculture, rural infrastructure, water supply, and vocational training. They will be separate from continuing development aid to Namibia. Germany says that representatives of the Herero and Nama were involved in the negotiations, though Berlin's direct dealings have been with the Namibian government. Germany gained control of the desert country in the 1880s and surrendered the territory to South Africa in 1915. Namibia gained independence in 1990. Dustin Barnes of USA Today reports UFO filmmaker releases 46-second video allegedly showing swarm of objects hovering near Navy ship. A UFO filmmaker shared a video clip on Thursday depicting radar footage he claimed shows a swarm of unidentified flying objects near a Navy ship off the coast of San Diego almost 2 years ago. Jeremy Corbell posted the 46-second clip on Twitter, saying it was taken from the USS Omaha on July 15, 2019. Corbell, a UFO enthusiast and filmmaker behind the 2018 documentary titled Bob Lazar, Area 51 and Flying Saucers, said the footage showed, quote, a significant UFO event series. In the clip, a radar screen is shown with several objects moving around the ship. At one point, an unidentified man is heard saying, quote, holy, expletive, they're moving fast, they're turning around, end quote. This isn't the first time Corbell has shared footage claiming to prove the existence of UFOs. An 18-second clip he shared showing three UFOs hovering over the USS Russell in 2019 was confirmed by the Navy as authentic, earlier this year, according to the New York Post. Thursday's shared footage comes a few days before a government-sanctioned report on unidentified aerial phenomena is expected to be sent to Congress. Some former federal officials have teased that the unclassified report will include unexplainable events. Luis Elizondo, former director of the Defense Department's Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, told 60 Minutes that some reported sightings don't have explanations. Quote, "We're going through our due diligence. Is it some sort of new type of cruise missile technology that China has developed? Is it some sort of high-altitude balloon that's conducting reconnaissance? Ultimately, when you have exhausted all those what-ifs and you're still left with the fact that this is in our airspace and it's real, that's when it becomes compelling and that's when it becomes problematic," Elizondo told the broadcast news outlet on a May 16th segment. And it's half past the hour, which means it's time to turn to the opinion page of today's Des Moines Register. At the top of the page is the Register's editorial, titled, "Time for Patience, Grace with Mask Wearing." You're fully vaccinated. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says you don't need to wear a mask during routine outings. So you head to the grocery store with a bare face for the first time in more than a year. This is one of those moments you've been looking forward to. But the employees are wearing masks. Most of the customers are, too. And boy, do you feel awkward. You don't want fellow customers to think you're an anti-masker. You don't have a sign around your neck that says you were injected with a second dose of Pfizer weeks ago. You don't want to make others feel uncomfortable. You fear now being on the receiving end of dirty looks. So maybe you pull out a mask out of your purse or pocket and put it on. On your way home, you stop at a garage sale. No one is wearing masks, so you don't either. We know that those fully vaccinated or well protected will gain more from deference than from confrontation. This is what a transitional period looks like, and transitions are frequently difficult. Just a few months ago, the people we saw not wearing masks were rejecting pandemic guidance. Now the ones not wearing masks may be vaccinated and following guidance. Please, everyone, have a little patience and grace during this time. We generally have no idea where strangers are in their mask-wearing lives. They may be fully vaccinated but required to wear a mask while working. They may be fully vaccinated but have cancer or other conditions that compromise their immunity and they don't feel safe. They may not be vaccinated and don't want to wear a mask. They may be too young to qualify for a shot right now. We don't necessarily know, and that's okay. At this point, we will collectively gain more from deference than from confrontation. What we do know, those of us who are fully vaccinated are well protected against serious illness and death from COVID-19. The Cleveland Clinic recently reported preliminary data showing 99% of the 4,300 admissions to the hospital between January and mid-April were patients who had not been fully immunized. Another set of data looking at hospital employees found pretty much the same thing. 4 months after a COVID-19 vaccine was offered to hospital workers, 99.7% of infections happened in unvaccinated employees. Quote, "This vaccine is highly effective to prevent our community from getting sick, not only our caregivers, but the community. We have data on both. It cannot be more clear the message that vaccines work and that it's the key action that we need to do to get back to our normal lives as they were before coronavirus," said Dr. Eduardo Mireles, director of the Medical Intensive Care Unit. "Vaccinated Iowans chose to listen to doctors and take a precaution that will help save our own lives, prevent us from contributing to the development of new virus variants, and protect those we come in contact with, including our children and others in the age group too young to vaccinate at this point. We are largely safe, resuming much of our pre-pandemic lives. That includes not worrying so much about who is wearing a mask and who isn't. Let's just buy our groceries and keep washing our hands." Again, this is the Register's editorial in today's Des Moines Register. In today's letters to the editor, Merle Walter of Mount Air writes, "Will Mediacom bother to air the Cy-Hawk game?" ABC is going to broadcast the Iowa State-Iowa football game this year. If you are a Mediacom subscriber in central Iowa, this is a problem. Mediacom has been blaming Tegna for the absence of WOI and KCWI for months. If you call Mediacom, you get a minute and a half spiel about Tegna causing the outage and encouraging subscribers to call Tegna to solve the problem. Mediacom offers a pittance payment on your bill to make up for this. I called and told them that if this was not resolved before this game, I was quitting them after decades of being a customer. I am asking all Iowa State and Iowa fans to do the same. I suggested that if Mediacom can't afford WOI and KCIW, it could drop Fox News to pay for them. Signed, Merle Walter of Mount Air. Denny Carney of Des Moines writes, Iowa, ever so gradually, is growing, going to the wayside. There is an old story about a frog immediately jumping out if it's tossed in boiling water, but dying without realizing it's boiling if you put it in cold water and slowly turn up the heat. I think that encapsulates perfectly what is happening in Iowa. The Iowa legislature and our governor are slowly dragging us toward their version of what Iowa should be like, which is somewhere around the 1950s. They have one song to sing each year about tax relief while underfunding schools, universities, government services, and state infrastructure. When citizens complain about potholes and deteriorating highways, long wait times for emergency services, or state prison personnel dying, they are really complaining about the lack of funding from the state. This legislature would rather make it easier to purchase a gun or tell women what medical procedures they can or cannot have, and make it easier to open enroll their children out of diverse schools. Signed, Denny Carney of Des Moines. Douglas Mansfield of Des Moines writes, Don't risk eating meat this holiday. With COVID-19 gradually releasing its deadly grip, this Memorial Day we can focus once again on the threat of our outdoor grill. Yes, that. Folks who grill hamburgers and hot dogs face a nasty choice. The U.S. Meat and Poultry Hotline advises grilling at high temperature to avoid food poisoning by E. coli and Salmonella bacteria. But the National Cancer Institute warns that high temperature grilling of processed meats generates compounds associated with cancer. Fortunately, we no longer need to choose between food poisoning and cancer. A bunch of enterprising U.S. food processors have met this challenge head-on by developing a rich variety of convenient, healthful, delicious, plant-based veggie burgers, veggie dogs, and soy nuggets. These products don't harbor nasty bugs or cancer-causing compounds. They have no cholesterol, saturated fats, drugs, hormones, and pesticides like their animal-based alternatives. Also, they are waiting for us in the frozen food section of our favorite supermarket, along with nut-based cheeses, milks, and ice creams. This Memorial Day, in the shadow of COVID-19, let's stay safe in more ways than one. Signed, Douglas Mansfield of Des Moines. The Register's opinion page today also includes a Your Turn guest column written by Scott Jennings, a Republican advisor, CNN political contributor, and partner at RunSwitch Public Relations. His column is titled, Blame Great Liberal Reordering for Lack of U.S. Workers. Arriving for a lunch out, I saw a sign at the restaurant's front door, quote, Unfortunately, due to being short-staffed, we will not be seating the restaurant to full available capacity at this time. We are adjusting to ensure a fantastic dining experience for all, end quote. Translation, a restaurant that survived the pandemic, nearly 20% of them closed, now can't find enough workers to survive the great liberal reordering of American society. But it isn't just restaurants. A local human resources person told me their outfit is having trouble filling roughly 20 open warehouse and manufacturing jobs. Starting pay is between $15 to $18 per hour, plus full health insurance benefits and 401k plans. The company will pay for your college tuition, too. Quote, Finding applicants and people who will come to work every day is a real problem, the HR rep told me. Why? Because we are paying people too much to stay home. Stimulus payments, enhanced and extended unemployment benefits, and other tax credits are more than enough for many people to literally take their jobs and shove them. The federal government has essentially devalued work while incentivizing dependency. Democrats have pounced on the pandemic like hungry jungle cats, using what Biden laughably called, quote, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, end quote, to effectively and unnecessarily make millions of Americans wards of the state. During the Great Depression, President Franklin D. Roosevelt used the federal bureaucracy to put people to work. Biden, on the other hand, is using it to keep Americans from it, despite more than 8 million job openings today. Quote, Give a man a dole, and you save his body and destroy his spirit. Give him a job, and you save both body and spirit, observed FDR's Works Progress Administration head Harry Hopkins, who would likely be canceled talking like that in today's Democratic Party. In April, economists had predicted the U.S. would gain over 1 million new jobs. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics report stunned with a meager 266,000 jobs. Business leaders, it seems, won't create new positions when they can't even fill the ones already open. Several Republican governors, at least 22 as of this writing, including Iowa's, have had enough, choosing to end the additional $300 weekly federal unemployment payment that comes on top of the regular unemployment benefit. No Democratic governor has yet taken the step, despite clear evidence that economic growth will suffer without a sufficient and willing labor pool. Biden's plan is clear: rhetorically manufacture an economic so-called crisis to lock in socialism's empty promise, to redistribute wealth in so-called equitable ways that pit rich versus poor, men versus women, and white people versus minorities, and ultimately, those who work against those who don't. It's a vicious cycle. The government has printed $6 trillion in the name of coronavirus relief, and Democrats are doling out enough of that largesse for millions of people to stay home while generating zero productivity. All this new currency is part of a $28 trillion national debt. Now we have inflation, which is driving up the cost of food and other necessities. Pretty soon, the people we are paying to stay home will argue that we aren't paying enough, as things become more expensive. And the Great Reordering will demand richer benefits be distributed so that the new non-working class can survive. This death spiral will continue until a political movement puts a stop to it, or something worse happens. See virtually every socialist country in history. This debate will truly come to a head in 2024, when the next campaign for the White House will either confirm this swift and painful lurch toward redistributionist, inflationary, and socialist policies, or reaffirm the nation-sustaining value of work with a conservative Republican's victory. Again, this is the opinion of Scott Jennings, a Republican advisor, CNN political contributor, and partner at RunSwitch Public Relations. Today's political cartoon in the Register is drawn by Mark Murphy of the USA Today Network, and it depicts a television screen showing America's daily news. On the screen are four news persons, all smiling big, toothy grins. One is labeled news, one labeled weather, one labeled sports, and one labeled mass shootings, and the image of the one labeled mass shootings has bullet holes across the person's screen, share of the screen. In opinions printed in USA Today, Bradley Jacobs Sigismund, an NYC-based journalist who's written for Bloomberg, Newsweek, and Us Weekly, is penning a TV pilot about a sports-averse gay dad with a soccer-obsessed son. His column today is titled, "Too Young to Admit I Was Gay, Here's How I Learned to Stop Complaining and Love Summer Camp." Shy and sports-averse, I was hardly sleepaway camp material, but by the summer's end I had changed, thanks to counselors who saw my hidden spark. A few weeks back, our son Lucas, aged 9, who surely owed an adventure after the masked-up pandemic summer of 2020, selected these electives for his upcoming time at sleepaway camp: the climbing wall, the Ninja Warrior course, and not one but two sessions of soccer. My picks, when I went to camp at Lucas's age, were a touch different: drama, singing, and two sessions of arts and crafts. Outdoorsy and athletic, Lucas told me and his other father, Jack, that he wants to maximize the experience and attend camp for all 7 weeks. Quote, "Dad and Pops, I can't wait to get to the woods," end quote. Quiet and flabby, I could only bear to attend for a fraction of that. Quote, "Mommy, do I really have to go?" End quote. See, I was never cut out for sleepaway camp, but by the summer's end, I had changed, and it was because of camp, and specifically, a handful of supportive counselors. The great indoors and outdoors. While too young to acknowledge I was gay, I was hardly fit to spend a summer with a bunch of boys in the wilderness. A lover of the great indoors, I was already deeply fixated on movies, TVs, and books. I shined in the schoolroom, far from the soccer field. I was attached to my mother, sister, and my female teachers. As my cousin says, I was always one of the girls. While the boys in my bunk were thrilled to play sports, I sat on the sidelines waiting for 3 p.m. when I got to dull the pain with M&Ms at the canteen. My nemesis, an aggressive kid named Micah, took advantage of my athletic ineptitude, constantly tripping and punching me. The sunset mosquitoes seemed to target me more than the other campers, munching me up and down my arms and legs. At night, I'd quietly sob myself to sleep. But then a funny thing happened once I stopped whining. With guidance from some empathetic counselors, camp made me a better version of myself. I discovered untapped skills. A chubby kid who never wanted to take off his shirt, I found I was actually decent at one sport, swimming, and the college-aged lifeguard counted as I clocked dozens of laps in the camp pool. When it came time for so-called color wars, an athletic competition where the camp was divided into teams, I advanced quickly, encouraged by a nurturing male leader who showed me the game was largely strategic, more brain than brawn. Plus, a trusted counselor slipped me some B1 pills to help solve my mosquito problem. Camp also gave me the chance during afternoon downtime to dig into new obsessions that would deepen as I grew into a teenager. One of them was music. When the other boys played tag outside, I was free to lie on my bunk with headphones, rewinding cassettes of singles again and again that I'd recorded from the radio. Most crucially, I fell in love with the 7:45 p.m. evening program, where all the bunks gathered in the central mess hall to watch skits and musical comedy. It was heaven for this future theater junkie. I was so enraptured by the presentations that by camp's end, staffers installed me as a mini MC, introducing acts and entertaining the campers, most of whom looked up at me either scornfully or bored out of their little minds. I didn't care. I was a natural. The next morning, I'd jump out of bed and immediately ask my male bunk counselors, "So what's the evening program tonight?" I was showing, and starting to embrace, my theatricality, my exaggerated mannerisms, my, well, campy behavior. Find your tribe. Still, I never went back to sleepaway camp. In those years, my parents were struggling, drifting toward their eventual separation and moving homes regularly. My sister and I changed schools 4 times in 4 years. Reflecting on it today, I wish I had returned to those woods every year. With a safe refuge from my family's issues, perhaps I would have benefited from the stability and developed confidence earlier. Maybe I could have found my tribe faster and come to accept that I was gay without so much self-torment. Many kids experience their first kiss at camp. Why not me? I know Lucas will succeed at camp in ways I never fathomed. He's already well ahead of the game, far more comfortable in his youthful skin than I ever was. Asked by a stranger in a park at age 5 if he needed help finding his mother, Lucas shrugged and said, "I have 2 dads," then rejoined his game of hide-and-seek. I'm excited for our son, at the outset of his wonder years, to start to unravel some of life's great mysteries in an environment designed to nurture one's character. A month after camp ended that long-ago summer, a memento arrived in the mail. It was the flimsiest of yearbooks, 8 or so pages stapled together with a section for each bunk. On my cabin's page, my counselors wrote, "Bradley's pet peeve, Micah. Guess he and I never got over our issues." But it said something else. Bradley's favorite quote, "What's the evening program?" I didn't get it at the time. But today, I see that like the best of mentors, those counselors were helping kids find their true selves. Those nurturing young adults, similar to a few key teachers I'd met in the following years, were celebrating campy little me. Again, this is the opinion of Bradley Jacobs Sigismund. Another opinion in today's USA Today is written by Suzette Hackney of USA Today, titled, "Indianapolis Colts Owner Jim Irsay Creates Family Initiative to Raise Awareness of Mental Health Disorders." As America begins to emerge from the darkest days of the pandemic, there's little doubt many of us are emotionally battered and bruised. Those suffering from depression, anxiety, or other mental illness could be on the brink of hopelessness or in full-blown crisis. Some racked with embarrassment and shame might want to retreat into isolation or avoid reaching out for help. But now is not the time, because there shouldn't be any stigma attached to mental illness. It's a message that Americans must embrace beyond Mental Health Awareness Month. It's so important, particularly during pandemic recovery, that Jim Irsay, billionaire owner of the Indianapolis Colts, created a Kicking the Stigma family initiative and raised more than $4.5 million this month to help generate awareness about mental health disorders and expand treatment options and resources. Irsay said the initiative was the brainchild of his three daughters, Carly, Casey, and Kaylin. Conversations around mental health and wellness and equitable access to treatment is the first step in helping people realize they are not alone in the struggle. Quote, "We're involved in so many different aspects of charitable giving, but we wanted to really focus on one and have a legacy that we could leave behind. We could get behind," Irsay told me. Quote, "Particularly with the pandemic going on, mental health is really at a crisis level. It already was at a crisis level before we got into the COVID situation, but afterwards, with the isolation, with the economic hardships, and those worried about self-preservation, it really became apparent that this was really, really needed," end quote. A counterpunch to the pandemic. Irsay characterized kicking the stigma as a counterpunch to the pandemic, an unintended consequence that can ultimately be viewed as a positive instead of a negative. Concrete statistics on how COVID-19 affected those suffering from obsessive-compulsive disorders, postpartum depression, or eating disorders, for example, aren't readily available, he said, but anecdotal evidence has shown Americans are in need of compassionate understanding. Quote, "We don't know the fallout effect for the next 5 or 10 years from the pandemic," Irsay said, "but I can assure you it has made the ground more unsettled and led to many, many other problems," end quote. Money from the inaugural fundraiser, which raised $2,273,449 and was matched by Irsay, will be used to support expanded programming by Mental Health America Indiana, the National Alliance on Mental Health, Greater Minneapolis, Project Healthy Minds, and Bring Change to Mind. The fund also will provide grants to Indiana-based nonprofits working in education, support, and advocacy of mental health. "It's a framework that can be used nationally," he said. "Using a grant formula, nonprofit agencies that offer mental health support and services in each state could widen their safety net with the help of additional resources." Quote, "I would love to look back 100 years from now and say, you know, 100 years ago, Kick the Stigma began, and now we've raised $2.2 trillion, end quote. Quote, "We know it affects every single household, every single family. Every person brushes across it in life," Irsay said of mental illness. Quote, "These illnesses, like all illnesses, such as cancer, heart disease, etc., they're all very difficult to take on and defeat. But when you add the stigma to illnesses that are life-threatening, and these are, it becomes just that more difficult," end quote. Zoom, working out, a holy dog. Irsay has had his fair share of heartbreak and public battles with addiction. His grandfather and father both from alcoholism. His sister, Roberta, was killed in a 1971 car crash at 14. His only brother, Tom, was born severely mentally impaired. He died in 1999 at age 45. Irsay became addicted to prescription drugs after he was treated for chronic hip and back pain. In 2002, he sought treatment after his name was linked to a federal and local investigation involving possible prescription drug fraud by a local plastic surgeon. In a 2010 interview with USA Today, Irsay openly detailed a long history of recreational drug use, including mushrooms, LSD, alcohol, and cocaine, as a younger man. And in 2014, Irsay went back into rehab after he was arrested for impaired driving and found with opioids in his system. I asked Irsay if he struggled with his own sobriety during the pandemic. He said thankfully he did not, and used the opportunity to focus on learning things like Zoom, working out, and spending time with his 3-year-old dog, Drake, who he refers to as his, quote, holy dog, end quote. Still, being unable to see his children and grandchildren was as difficult for him as it was for millions of other Americans. Quote, "I'm diligent about my recovery," Irsay told me. "It's like amazing grace. It comes from a higher power, and it just starts with the willingness for people to say, help me, I surrender, I can't do it. God, you can. I'm turning my life and my will over to the care of God," end quote. A hole in his soul filled with service. Irsay described a hole in his soul that can only be filled by being selfless and of service to others. He inherited a franchise football team and saw the glory of a Super Bowl win. He said, "There's nothing more fulfilling in life than giving of yourself, and addressing mental illness could change the fabric of this nation." Quote, "It just struck a big chord with me because I know it's been pervasive in this world for the human race for a long time, and certainly in my family," Irsay told me. "The worst thing with the stigma with mental illnesses is people feel alone, And if you feel alone, that's never, never a good thing. So that's really important to me, you know, not just to create legacies, but hopefully leave funding behind that allows the legacies to grow and flourish to create a better human existence and make the world better. End quote. Well done, Mr. Irsay. Well done. And this is the opinion of national columnist Suzette Hackney, a member of USA Today's editorial board. Returning to the news, Trevor Hughes of USA Today writes, "Worried about COVID-19, Navajo Nation ignores CDC, keeps masks and social distancing." As the COVID-19 pandemic began spreading across the world, Graham Bayel at first figured he'd be safe inside his home along the dusty red dirt roads of the Navajo Nation reservation. But as more and more news came out about how the virus spread and how quickly, Bayel got nervous. At the time, he was living in a traditional one-room home called a hogan with 11 other people. No running water, no toilet. Like many of his approximately 400,000 fellow Diné, most of whom live on the 27,000-square-mile reservation sprawling across northern New Mexico, Arizona, and a small portion of southern Utah, Bayel, age 31, knew medical care could be a long drive away. And the Navajo, who suffer from high rates of diabetes and obesity, have historically been susceptible to viral infections, including the 2009 H1N1 swine flu epidemic. Worried about protecting both his own health and of those around him, Bayel moved into a tent, powering his cell phone via solar panels. He still lives there today, wearing a mask on the rare times he's around others, even though he and most other Navajo have been vaccinated. A year after experiencing one of the deadliest COVID-19 outbreaks in the nation, the Navajo Nation is rapidly approaching herd immunity via an aggressive vaccination campaign. Still, tribal leaders said they will continue to require curfews, gathering limits, and masks, even though federal health guidelines state those restrictions are generally unnecessary among vaccinated people. Health experts and Navajo alike said generations of lessons about how susceptible Native Americans are to outside diseases and infections have taught them to be extra careful about public health. Quote, "On the Navajo Nation, you have a collective mentality that's there. What I do affects the people around me, my family, and therefore I need to be more responsible and more careful because it's not just about me," Bayel said. "So I don't mind wearing a mask. I don't mind getting vaccinated. Because if there are still people who are dying from this virus, then I have an obligation to take care of myself and the people around me." End quote. COVID-19 hit many urban coastal areas hardest at first, then quickly sickened Native Americans across the country. Native Americans were 3.5 times more likely to get the coronavirus than non-Hispanic white Americans, and their mortality rate was twice of white Americans, according to Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data. Native Americans were also more likely to get sick younger than other Americans, with 40 years old being the average age of the infected, compared to 51 years old for white Americans. Early data showed that the COVID-19 case rates among Native Americans were nearly 600 per 100,000, compared to 169 per 100,000 for white Americans, according to data that the CDC admits likely understates the severity of the situation because of poor data collection regarding COVID cases and race and ethnicity. And that's it for our second hour of the Register on IRIS. Thank you for listening. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.